Throughout the 1980s, a shadow hung over the country of Belgium. Nowhere was this malignant fear felt more than in the area around the country's capital, Brussels. This shadow went by a variety of names. They started out as the Gang of Brabant, called De Bende van Nevel by the locals. Both names were reflective of the area they terrorized. This gang, which consisted of three unknown subjects, began rather small. They stole goods from grocery stores and restaurants, but they would continue to escalate. Over the span of a few years, their reputation grew, as did their brutality. They became as feared in Belgium as figures such as the Zodiac or Jack the Ripper. But their targets did not exist in isolated pockets. Their victims weren't people inside of a confined space or in some sleepy lover's lane in the woods. They weren't of a particular age range or social bracket. Their targets were everyone. People just like you and I, heading to the store to get a six-pack of beer or ingredients for tonight's dinner. Their targets were in the one spot they felt safe, in public, and occasionally even in broad daylight. What began as a seemingly harmless group of thieves who began their crime spree with a single firearm in 1982 had grown to epic proportions just a couple of years later. The gang eventually earned another nickname, the Mad Killers of Belgium, and theories regarding their identities infected Belgian culture. Even to this day, you can't ask someone in Belgium about the case without getting their opinion on who's responsible. On the Random History of Belgium podcast, the host reflects upon this case, calling it Belgium's version of the JFK assassination. And I find that fitting, not only because of how much it affected the country, growing public distrust and resentment of their own government, but injecting the zeitgeist of an entire nation with conspiracy theories, rumors, and gossip. While it has been over 30 years since the killers last acted, their memory lives on in the survivors, the investigators that have yet to uncover any answers, and the dark cloud that has yet to lift from Belgium itself. This is the story of the Brabant Killers. Welcome to the Unresolved Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Whelan, and this episode is undoubtedly the beginning of a new era for the podcast. Not only is this the third European story I have decided to cover, but it is also the kickoff of Season 3, which is going to be the biggest and most interesting season yet. If you are unaware, I'm going to be pursuing the podcast full-time over the next year or two, a prospect that fills me with joy. It has always been my goal to get to this point, covering mysteries regularly, and trying my hand to best explain them in a story format. If you would like to support this little journey of mine, hopefully getting episodes out once a week, you could head to patreon.com/unresolvedpod. There, you could get access to a variety of perks, including some recently made swag, commercial-free episodes, and even participate in a monthly episode poll. I'll also be posting more behind-the-scenes content moving forward, including interviews with noted figures in the true crime community and subjects of mysteries themselves. But without taking up any more of your time, I will get into the origins of our story. If you will, let's turn back the dial to 1982, where Belgium, as a nation, is in the middle of a proverbial crossroad. Belgium is a country divided. Roughly 59% of the population speak Dutch, primarily, and another 40% speak French. This is painting with a pretty broad brush, I recognize, but I like to think of it as a perfect example of how a single nation can be split in such a way. Wedged between France, Germany, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands, the history of Belgium is a long and storied one. However, it is not always a particularly happy one, despite the culmination of Belgian works achieved through the centuries, most notably during the Renaissance. Belgium takes great pride in its own history, whether it be the country's independence gained in 1839, the fact that the nation did its part to resist Nazi occupation throughout World War II, or the storied arts cultivated over the years. But throughout that time, they had to deal with several battles, which had nothing to do with the area itself being fought in Belgium. The Battle of Waterloo, fought between Napoleon and a combined English-Prussian force, is one such example. So used to being Europe's battleground was Belgium, that when World War II began, the nation knew that their proximity was going to drag them into the conflict eventually. But even then, they remained neutral up until Nazi forces invaded, and then had to deal with the consequences of inaction. The government was forced into exile. Many of the citizens followed to the United Kingdom, providing support for the Allies, but others stayed behind and participated in both active and passive resistance to the Nazis. The Belgian town of Bastogne, known to many of us as one of the battlegrounds from HBO's Band of Brothers, houses a museum that goes into this resistance. If any of you get the chance to visit it, I would really recommend it. Beforehand, I had never really considered Belgium's role in World War II, but it really does a beautiful job of portraying it. Roughly 1% of Belgium's population, roughly 90,000 people, were killed during World War II, and an eighth of their entire economy collapsed during the conflict. This may seem like a collection of random facts, but I think it provides a glimpse into Belgian culture, as seen from an outsider's perspective. The country, while full of amazing people, was getting used to being thwarted. They were a nation of people used to being Europe's doormat. After all, they didn't establish their own independence until the mid-19th century, at which point their neighbors had had close to a millennium to develop unique cultures and identifiers. This seemed to result in a population that, going into the 1980s, was slightly jaded and struggling to adapt to the world's new wave, so to speak. After all, when you had two halves of a country speaking entirely different languages, it results in a nation that isn't totally united behind one grand vision. This is most clear when it comes to Belgium's law enforcement agencies. At this point, in the early 1980s, Belgian law enforcement wasn't as fully developed as it could have been. Many agencies were acting in direct competition with one another, separated by geographical borders and language barriers. So, now that I've given you my best background on Belgium, I just want you to keep this in mind throughout the next however many episodes. While in the US, we've been able to count on law enforcement agencies like the FBI to oversee major criminal operations, Belgium, at this time, really had no such thing. You had distinctly different police departments operating under the thumb of the Minister of Defense, but by and large, they were all pretty autonomous. They handled regional matters, and usually consulted the Gendarmerie, militarized police, when it came to serious matters. This system, built on smaller, regional forces, sounds good in concept. But it had created an environment where there was no communication or cooperation between departments, and this environment was ripe for abuse. March of 1982. President Ronald Reagan had just placed sanctions on Libyan oil exports for the country's involvement in supporting terrorism groups. The DeLorean Motor Company has been struggling financially, so its factory in Belfast is put into receivership. And the Commodore 64 8-bit home computer is already well on its way to becoming one of the most hyped electronics releases of all time. But in a small sleeping Belgium town named Dinant, a new era is beginning. The day is March 13th, an unlucky Saturday. The setting is a small weapons shop where trouble is stirring. Two men, wearing dark outfits, break into an armory. They quickly accomplish their goal, which is finding a weapon to steal. It is a Faul, spelled F-A-U-L, caliber 10, a small handheld shotgun with two barrels. It looks like a relic, but one that could do its job quite easily. The weapon would be recovered a few years later, in November of 1986, but the people responsible for stealing it would never be identified. The shop owner gets a good look at the two culprits as they make their amateurish getaway. One suspect, the perceived leader of the operation, is described as being between 20 and 30 years old, being very tall and slender, about 2 meters tall, with light brown or blonde hair. The other man looks older than the first. He's approximately 50 years old, with a grizzled demeanor that makes him look tough as nails. He's described as being in good shape, and standing reasonably tall, around 6 feet, but was notably shorter than the first man. This would be just the first sighting of these men, but they were literally just getting started on the biggest crime spree in Belgian history. Roughly 2 months later, on a Monday, May 10th, a man was parking his Austin Allegro along a street in Ixelles, an area in southern Brussels. This man was suddenly accosted by two strangers with French accents. One man was very tall, with thin black hair and a mustache, but wearing a cap to somewhat obscure his features. The other was smaller, with a mustache of his own. His hair was described as being very wavy and graying. The two men, carrying long-barreled revolvers, stole the car from the man. Little did they know that the Austin Allegro, which looked to be a sports car in a good condition, was actually low on gas and had been running pretty poorly. The Allegro was discovered the next morning in the area of Lembeek, roughly 20 kilometers southwest. Apparently, after discovering that the Austin Allegro wasn't suitable for their future plans, the thugs ditched it after discovering a blue Volkswagen Santana which was more to their liking. The Santana was stolen from the floor of a VW showroom, showing that these criminals were bold in their activities. They sped off into the night, continuing their preparation for what was to come. On August 14th, a Saturday, the gang began making their presence known in Belgium. Two men, armed with weapons, showed up at a grocery store late at night. The first of the men, described as being tall with a heavy build, was wearing a balaclava with a small visor. He was armed with a rifle, or what might have been a sawed-off carbine, and kept watch at the front of the store. The second man broke the glass door and entered the grocery store, which was closed at the time. The thieves began to rummage the store for what seemed like random goods. They stole wine, champagne, and apparently even other groceries like coffee. An anonymous phone call alarmed the police to the presence of the thieves, most likely called in by a troubled neighbor that heard the glass shattering. Three local police officers responded to the crime, but a gunfight quickly broke out between the two parties. Details about what happened specifically during the skirmish aren't widely known, but the end result was one injured police officer. The other two officers escaped unharmed, and the two bandits made their getaway in the blue Volkswagen Santana stolen 3 months prior. Over the next few weeks, the local police were wondering what the August 14th conflict was all about. For all they knew, the bandits were just a couple of gangsters interested in stealing some groceries and alcohol. But the next month would prove that they were anything but just a couple of simple-minded criminals. They had some bigger plans, and they needed the firepower to make it happen. On September 30th, three unknown gunmen showed up at another weapon store named De Keyser Armory, this time in a town called Waver, just outside of Brussels. Witnesses recall the three suspects as such. Perpetrator number one, a leader of the group, was close to 2 meters tall, with a medium build, chestnut-colored hair, and a mustache. Perpetrator number two was described as being in his early to mid-30s, with a medium build, black hair, thick eyebrows, and a mustache. Perpetrator number three, surprisingly, was described as having a heavier build, but was more well-built. A larger guy, perhaps, but a lot of that was described as being muscle, and he had light brown hair. The three gunmen robbed the store in the morning hours just before noon, forcing the shop owner and the two customers onto the floor of the armory. When they responded slowly to the gunmen's wishes, they were beaten. The gunmen knew what they were looking for, as they searched out over 15 firearms in total. Most were pistols, of varying makes and models, but they grabbed around 5 rifles, all of which were submachine guns. Investigators would later say that the gunmen weren't just grabbing weapons willy-nilly. They had done their homework, and not only knew what they wanted, but where it was, along with the applicable ammunition. One police officer patrolling the nearby area responded to the call that came in, expecting it to be a few small-time criminals. Unfortunately, he became the first victim of the trio when they began making their getaway in the blue Volkswagen Santana. Headed towards Brussels, the call soon came in that an officer was down. Fatally wounded, police would later learn that he had died at the scene. However, a team of gendarmerie police officers were preparing a response, and they planned to intercept the bandits on their way to Brussels. I haven't really spoken at all about gendarmerie, since it's not really a concept that we have here in America. However, gendarmes, as the individual soldiers are called, are basically the cross between a military member and a police officer. They serve in a federal police role, but stick to regional areas, if that makes any sense. If you've listened to the Alcacer Girl series, you can basically equate them with the Spanish Civil Guard. A team of these gendarmes were preparing to intercept the runaway bandits, and, using a vehicle of theirs, blocked off one of the escape routes that would undoubtedly be used by the criminals. Unfortunately, a minor blockade did not deter these 3 criminals. They plowed their VW Santana into the parked gendarmerie vehicle, and used the crash as momentum to exit the vehicle and begin shooting. These were men that were clearly not prepared to get caught anytime soon. They were utilizing military tactics against military police, and using their submachine guns in the process. The gendarmes, despite having advanced training, were under-equipped and overmatched by these 3 gunmen. 2 of the gendarmerie police were shot and wounded during this exchange, but they would survive their injuries. The 3 criminals made their escape in the blue Santana, which was now smoking from gunfire to the engine and other mechanical components. Police would later find the Santana in the nearby woods, having been doused in gasoline and burned, destroying almost any evidence that could have been recovered. At this point, police were absolutely stumped. These crimes, while haphazard, involved at least 2 different descriptions of the main perpetrator, the man who they believed to be the leader of the group. In one instance, he was described as having blonde hair. In the next offense, he was described as having dark hair with a mustache. Finally, he was described as having chestnut hair, but still had his mustache. However, this criminal was becoming known for his height. It was the hallmark of his description, and would continue to be so. Over the years, it would earn him the moniker of the Giant, a name that would become feared in Belgian culture. Throughout the first few crimes, the second perpetrator seemed to jump back and forth between 2 different men. At least, that's what the descriptions pointed to. The first was younger, in his mid-20s to mid-30s, and he was a good height, but pretty average in that regard. He was also in good shape, with dark features that were often obscured by his clothing or masks. Sometimes, the second offender was described as being older, in his mid-50s, with graying, wavy hair, and gruff features that made him look tough. Obviously, a far cry from someone described as being in their mid-20s. Police had been trying to reconcile these varying differences, assuming that the crimes were the work of multiple gangs or groups. But in this final attack, the theft of weapons from a gun shop, they had their answer. There were 3 gunmen, all working together. It appeared that the third perpetrator, who began to be known by his nickname of the Old Man, operated as the group's driver on more than one occasion. That left the other 2, the aforementioned Giant and the second gunman, to be in charge of the robberies and the violent assaults. Unfortunately, the second gunman, the younger one present throughout most of the crimes, would earn himself a moniker of his own. It was the Killer. On the morning of Wednesday, December 23rd, 1982, a man by the name of Mark van den Einde was checking in on his father. His father, a 72-year-old who had served in the Spanish Civil War years beforehand, was now the caretaker for the Biersel Castle. His son, Mark, had gotten him the job, having been a cook at the restaurant there. At least this job was more stable than his father's previous profession, that of a taxi driver, a factoid that would come into relevance just a month later. On this morning, Mark drove up to the castle grounds, with his wife and children in the car with him. They were planning to go to the nearby Halley Market for Christmas shopping, something that filled the entire family with anticipation for the upcoming holiday. Mark van den Einde honked a few times, but his normally punctual father was nowhere to be found. On occasions like this, Jose was usually sitting on the front stoop, hat in hand and ready to go. Fearing the worst, Mark decided to go in and check on his father. Since he worked there as a cook, he had keys to enter the establishment. The large stone structure, a castle, was overly quiet. Mark began walking up the steps toward his father's room. He knocked a few times, and was surprised to get no response. When Mark entered his father's upstairs bedroom of the inn, he was shocked and horrified at what he saw. Jose van den Einde had been bound, undressed, and was laying on his right side on his bed. His wrists were bound behind his back with a scarf belonging to the FC Bruges, a team that van den Einde supported. By the time he was spotted by his own son, he had been dead for several hours. The cause of death was multiple gunshots to the head, 7 in fact. 5 of the rounds were grouped towards the ear, but 2 veered slightly upwards by an inch or two. Jose van den Einde, the elderly caretaker of the hostel, was a man with ties to several activist groups. Most notably, he has long been rumored to have been involved in the far right-wing activist groups that were active at the time, which may or may not have had white supremacist ideals. However, I will state that these are all just rumors. Rumors that have been a part of the many theories and gossip from the years since. However, these rumors surfaced when it came out that Jose van den Einde had fought on the side of Francisco Franco in the Spanish Civil War. Franco was a military dictator who had gained the support of Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini during the conflict, which was by itself a military coup. Van den Einde had kept strong sympathies for this nationalist party, and was apparently still an activist for the cause. Forensics would later link this seemingly random murder to the crimes of the Brabant killers. At the time, though, police had no idea what they were looking at. Van den Einde was a man with many potential enemies. After all, he had served in a brutal, bloody conflict years beforehand, and he had potential ties to many unsavory people. Of course, all of this doesn't include the theories that surfaced in the years afterwards. That Jose van den Einde had been brutally tortured, crucified, beaten to an inch of his life before death, etc. Thankfully, most of these are just rumors. A second autopsy, based on photos and notes of the original, was published in 2007 and included no details of mutilations or sacrificial offerings. However, Mark van den Einde, his own son, recalled in interviews seeing terrible wounds upon his father's body, what looked like bruises from impacts to his head, and cigarette burns on his chest. The only reason that police were originally suspicious of this crime was that the perpetrators, whoever they were, would steal some random goods from the inn during their execution of Jose van den Einde. These goods included wine, champagne, and coffee. However, despite this info, police would be no closer to solving this murder in 2017 than they were at the end of 1982. Mark van den Einde, the victim's son, has gone on the record to express his discontent with the local authorities and their investigation. Most of the evidence they collected, which included belongings of the victim, his father Jose, have still not been returned and/or gone missing. None of the rumors involving the case would be confirmed. Those of van den Einde's ties to right-wing terrorist groups, the rumors of torture and mutilation, etc. But when police would uncover weapons belonging to the Brabant killers in the latter half of the 1980s, it would confirm that they had been used to shoot and murder Jose van den Einde. Why they shot him, though, is still the biggest mystery regarding this case. As 1982 came to a close, the legend of the Brabant killers was still growing. At this point, they had accumulated a handful of victims. 2 were dead, the police officer in Waver, and now Jose van den Einde. But a handful more had suffered injuries related to gunfights and violent assaults. Sadly, The criminals that would become known as the Brabant Killers were still just getting started. As the year had gone on, you could see that these three men were getting more confident in their role as violent criminals, and becoming more brazen with every attack. Many theorized that their early assaults were simply hampered by a lack of firepower, but after the September robbery of the armory, they were ready to wage war on an entire populace. To be continued in part 2 of the Brabant Killers, in which I will cover their entire 1983 campaign of terror and the various crimes they committed throughout it.